brought to you by Head Start Basketball.
The more you let kids play, I think they should just be falling in love with the way their body moves with other bodies in the space, the way they have that humanizing experience, the way they feel a citizen in that community of the court and of the players, the way they solve problems with nobody telling them how to solve those problems. I think that's the way you learn how to play basketball. Intergenerational.
Dave Hollander just released his new book, How Basketball Can Save the World, 13 Guiding Principles for Reimagining What's Possible. Hollander is in his 15th year at New York University, where he serves as the Assistant Dean of Real World and Clinical Professor with the Preston Robert Tisch Institute for Global Sport. His only-of-its-kind humanities course, How Basketball Can Save the World, received international media attention, including features from CBS News, Slam, the Associated Press, the Washington Post, and the New York Times. On April 12, 2022, major Italian media credited Hollander and his class for helping sway the Vatican to recognize the first-ever patron saint of basketball. Dave is a sought-after advisor to top brands in marketing, sports, entertainment, culture, and education. He frequently comments in top-tier media, including the Los Angeles Times, Boston Globe, Chicago Tribune, USA Today, ABC News, CNN, Bloomberg, and NPR. He sits on a number of advisory boards, including for ESPNW, the Earl Monroe New Renaissance Basketball School, and the NYU Entrepreneurial Institute. One of NYU's most popular professors, Hollander is the recipient of NYU's highest faculty honor, 2019 NYU Distinguished Teaching Award. Hollander's signature innovative experiential program, Real World, is one of the hottest programs at NYU, partnering with 45 A-list organizations like Nike, Porsche, JetBlue, Ace Hotel, and Samsung. Axios has called Real World the future of higher education. Hey, Hoopheads, I wanted to take a minute to shout out our partners and friends at Dr. Dish Basketball. Their Dr. Dish shooting machines are undoubtedly the most advanced and user-friendly machines on the market. Learn more at drdishbasketball.com and follow their incredible content at Dr. Dish B-Ball on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube. Mention the Hoopheads podcast and save an extra $300 on the Dr. Dish Rebel, All-Star, and CT models. Visit drdishbasketball.com for details. That's a great deal, Hoopheads. Get your Dr. Dish shooting machine today.
Hi, this is Rob Brost, head boys basketball coach at Bolingbrook High School in Illinois, and you're listening to the Hoopheads podcast.
Prepare like the pros with the all-new Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Fast Draw has been the number one play diagramming software for coaches for years. You'll quickly see why Fast Model Sports has the most compelling and intuitive basketball software out there. For a limited time, Fast Model is offering Hoopheads listeners 15% off Fast Draw and Fast Scout. Just use the code HHP15 at checkout to grab your discount, and you'll be on your way to more efficient game prep and improve communication with your team. Fast Model also has new coaching content every week on its blog, plus play and drill diagrams on its playbank. Check out the links in the show notes for more. Fast Model Sports is the best in basketball. Be prepared to take some notes and challenge your mind as you listen to this episode with Dave Hollander, NYU professor and author of the book, How Basketball Can Save the World. Hello and welcome to the Hoopheads podcast. It's Mike Klinzing here without my co-host Jason Sunkel tonight, but I am pleased to be joined by Dave Hollander, New York University professor, teacher of the class, The 13 Principles and How Basketball Can Save the World, and also the author of the new book of the same name, How Basketball Can Save the World. Can't wait to talk to Dave Hollander. Dave, welcome to the Hoopheads pod.
Mike, I know we've been waiting to do this for a while, so I'm really excited to be here. Thank you.
Absolutely. I'm thrilled to have you on. I can't wait to see where this conversation is going to go. For all of our audience out there, I think this is going to be one of our most unique and interesting episodes. So I am looking forward to diving in, Dave. Let's start by going back in time. To write a book like this, to teach a course like this, you obviously have to have a love for the game of basketball. So tell me about where that love started back when you were a kid.
Yeah, I mean, it's in the backyard where my father did something, I want to say unusual, but he took, he says it's 15 by 15. It felt more like 12 feet by 12 feet, a blacktop square. And he put down a double stanchion hoop, not one of these shell hoops, like a, you know, full backboard. And I had two older brothers. And I think when I was about 6 years old, I was trying to heave that thing underhand. And that court became a family center and later became a personal sanctuary and later became just a neighborhood gathering point where I could access the game, myself, my imagination. And I think that's where it began.
When you were a kid, who was the player that resonated with you the most? Was there a guy that you watched that you were like, yeah, that's the guy. That's who I want to be. Huh.
Yeah. I was fortunate, to have, a lot of role models. My brother Andy, primarily, who I thought was like the greatest basketball player I'd ever seen. But I also grew up in the era where there were two professional leagues, the ABA and the NBA. I grew up in Northwest New Jersey, so we rooted for the New York teams. And Walt Frazier for the New York Knicks and Julius Irving, Dr. J, for the New York Nets were everything to me. Those guys were the artists. They were the Picasso and Matisse of my world.
My first recollection of basketball on TV is the Dr. J dunk contest in 1976. And I can still, you know how you have those seminal pictures in your mind that just sort of are flashpoints that they just stick with you. And I don't have any context around that Dr. J foul line dunk, but I still remember I have a picture of me sitting on the couch watching that dunk in the All-Star game. And I don't have any context to it, but Dr. J was my guy. When I got the first pair of Dr. J leather Converse shoes when I was in seventh grade, I think I was over the world. There was nothing better. Doc was my guy for sure.
Yeah, no, and I'll give you another image. My first professional sports experience, the first game I ever went to, a professional sporting game of any kind, was Game 7 in the Nassau Coliseum, 1974, when the New York Nets, Dr. J, Mr. K, Larry Keenan, Super John Williamson, Billy Paulus the Whopper, won their first ABA championship. I was there, screaming myself hoarse with my two older brothers. And I told Jay this when he was a guest in my class last year. And it was a nice moment for both of us.
I'm sure. Yeah, that's incredible. I think ABA Dr. J is sort of lost to history because there just isn't much film of that era. But when by the time Doc got to the NBA, obviously he was still incredible, but you think about what an athlete, and I'm sure you know it better than anybody else, just what an athlete Doc was during those ABA days. And then when he got to the league and just the way he carried himself and just how just artistic he was as a player just is what made him so special. I think historically he's still chronically underrated how good he was when you factor in, especially what he did in the ABA.
Yeah, that's right. He, all this stuff, the Jordan, Dr. J invented it.
You got to look at the shot around Kareem and Lansbury, right? That is probably the most incredible shot in the history of basketball. I know you've seen it, but the photo that's taken from above when he's got the ball like way outside the baseline and you're just looking at it going, how does the guy get from that position where he is to being able to actually finish that shot? It's unreal.
That's one of the beauties of basketball to me is that defiance of gravity, which, you know, is one of those principles that I'm big on, transcendence. It's what basketball stands for. Not just because, you know, other sports have, you know, phenomenal moments of human achievement, but this game asks you to elevate, asks you to go up, asks you to go beyond and what we're allowed to do as earthlings, which stands for the idea that we must do more. We must see beyond what's in front of our face. That's the only way a world goes forward. That kind of thinking.
It's so true. I think during my day job, I teach elementary physical education, and I've taught also in the elementary classroom. And I think that transcendence principle that you talk about is something that is a challenge with a lot of today's youth, and getting them to see beyond what's right in front of them, whether that's the next 3 seconds, what I have to do to defend myself or go after someone, or whether I just need to be able to see what I do, the choices that I make, what the consequences of those choices are, whether they're good or bad. And I think that transcendence of basketball, of going in and just being able to elevate yourself, as you said throughout the book, I think one of the things that goes along with that, that's another theme that came through to me, is you talk about a lot in a lot of the different principles about the fact that basketball is played on a much smaller, in this case, court compared to a field of like soccer or football. And the players are out there in shorts and a tank top, and the fans are close. And so you get to see them, I think, as human beings. And to me, that's one of the things that separates basketball, but also then connects the players on the court with the fans. And you get to see these moments. Not only do you get to see them performed athletically, but you're also seeing the human side of them. And to me, I think that's what makes basketball special compared to, I'd say, other sports, if that makes any sense.
Well, it makes total sense to me. I love other sports. I consume and play other sports, and I find great meaning in all of them. But basketball, as you just explained, is more human in size. It's all about space and sharing space and negotiating space with each other. And when you're in an intimate space and there's only five of you, immediately you start thinking about each other. You're forced to interconnect if you do it right. And that kind of mind, well, it goes to like this higher level human relationship called empathy. Basketball is an empathy lab. We're all constantly, the Mojave poet, Pulitzer Prize winner, Natalie Diaz, who played in 2 Final Fours, amazing. She talks about how when you walk on a court with total strangers who you don't know, what happens in basketball is immediately, fluidly, continuously, you got to find ways to know them and they you. And in that way, you enact a kind of family in that time, in that space.
I love the connection that you make throughout the book. And one of the things that I found to be the most compelling for me is the fact that you weave in a lot of stories about NBA players and college players and WNBA players and lots of names that people would have heard of. But I do think that so many of the stories and the principles in the book come from playground pickup basketball. And I've always said on the podcast here that I got an opportunity to play high school basketball as a good high school player, and I got an opportunity to play Division I basketball, and I was a pretty good college player. And yet, when I think back to some of my most favorite moments in the game, those moments took place on a playground, in a park, on my driveway, with friends, with people that I didn't even know. And you start talking about one of your principles is human alchemy, and just being able to put together 5 different people and have them figure out, okay, what do we have to do to be able to win? And if you're at the playground, obviously you have to win so you can keep playing. And I always sort of transpose that and go the other way. And I'm just curious to hear your response to this, but I know you've played in games where you get on a team with somebody that you're like, after playing with them for 3 trips up the court, you're like, I never want to play with this person again because they don't understand the
the process of human alchemy when it comes to a team. They are very much a they are very much an individual in a collective game, which I know is another one of your principles. Just talk a little bit about from the perspective of pickup basketball and how you how much it can work when you have people that get it, and then unfortunately you have some people that don't get it.
Well, in getting it is the idea. That's what basketball is about. You know, the course I teach, How Basketball Can Save the World, looks at what the game was intended to do and how the game is operated in the world, what the world has told us it means. You're right that, you know, there's these elite levels of play, NBA, you know, Division One, you know, AAU, and that's a real special kind of level of achievement. But the game was actually meant as a social institution. It was meant to allow people who were in cramped environments or unable to have like recreational or social relationships with other people. It wanted them to have a space that they could easily access and in the exercise of playing this game, be better people. It wasn't about going to the NBA. It wasn't about winning a championship. It was about the experience of playing the game, of not running over people, but passing the ball and moving and sharing space. So when you talk about pickup, to me, that's the purest form of what the game was intended to be. You show up in a public space with other people, strangers. Nobody checks your ID. There's no membership card required, no passport, no citizenship check, no credit check, no gatekeeper. And you're put together with four other people. And the point is to figure out how to do what each of you does in a way that alchemizes you. And what that means is, yeah, it's not about you get to stay who you are and they get to stay who they are. No, it's about you all got to become something else, something different and thus better in order to, yeah, achieve the goal, win. I believe that that's what it takes for a society to go to the next place it ought to be. You know, we just got out of a pandemic. A lot of people forget, but I bet during that time when we were all, you know, forced to kind of isolate or distance or behave in ways that, you know, were really scary and not comfortable. I bet a lot of us said, you know what? When this is over, I'm going to change. The whole thing's got to change. All these institutions have to change. Nothing's working. We got to change this whole thing. That's the alchemy a society now is talking about. How do we repurpose these office buildings? How should people go back to work? What should we really do about healthcare? You know, how should, you know, we re-evaluate, reset, reform, imagine. That's a basketball mindset. That's a pickup basketball mindset. That's the way citizens are supposed to look at the world. I list some examples in the book. But pickup, you know, that's a society that says, listen, man, if you can't alchemize with us, then we're not going to get along. It's not going to go well. If you do alchemize with us, this is going to be a beautiful experience. And thus is the challenge of just being here with other people. It's a pickup basketball game.
All right, let's go back because I want to, before we dive deep into some of the concepts in the book, take me back to when this idea first started to percolate in your mind of putting the course together, of thinking about, hey, how can basketball relate to some of these bigger societal issues that we're facing, that we're talking about, that we're going to talk about more tonight. Yeah. Just when did the idea come to you, and did it come in a moment? Was it something that grew on you over time? Just what was the process for putting this whole concept together?
I mean, I think I've been thinking about this since I was six. And then around 15 years ago, I read a book called How Soccer Explains the World by Franklin Foer. It's a great book. And he was trying to talk about this new idea called globalization. And he used the World Cup as a peg to analyze each country through the way it plays soccer, which could tell you about that country, which was going to help us understand this idea of globalization. And I thought to myself when I read that book 15 years ago, this is great, but I know basketball actually does this better and can not just explain the world, but save the world, can help us solve acute 21st century problems. And as I looked around, I said, there's a lot of things that are broken. And around 2016, this was kind of going through my head. I was saying there's so much division. The media is broken. Governments are broken. Schools are broken. Higher education, the environment. And then I thought about how I felt when I played basketball and how that experience gives me peace and balance and my relations with others gets right. I feel my whole self integrated. I feel like there's a sense of the world has gone away and I'm existing in a really harmonious space. I get quiet. And I said, oh, there's got to be a way that I can, and I know other people play basketball. We've talked about, we feel the same way. So I'm a professor. My job is to think about these kinds of things and go research them and see if there's any validity to it. I did. I built a syllabus and I said, I'm going to explore basketball as a new vocabulary, a new language to solve old problems that have been governed by old ideas with this from the same kind of old archetypes of leadership. And that's how this course started.
Did people get it right away, or were people kind of looking at you side-eyed when you first brought the idea?
Most people are like, oh, great. We're going to talk about the NBA. And I was like, no, that we're not. In fact, we're almost not going to talk about that at all. I want to talk about this thing, this institution, this social form. So, I mean, people were in higher education. It took me a minute to push it through. And then people were like, well, you know, just let them go. Let them try this thing. But I think most people did get it. Most people were like, I think I know what he's going to say. I think I know what this is all about. Because so many people had intuited what basketball meant to them and how all the things that I talked about, peace and sanctuary and balance, they had felt it too. And they wanted that articulation of it. They wanted that language. And so I think people showed up. Some were skeptical. Some felt like it was an attack against their other favorite sport, whether it was soccer or baseball, but it wasn't that at all. They soon found that, you know, there was a lot of depth and it just kind of gave voice to what they had kind of already understood.
How much did you already know about the story of James Naismith and the invention of the game? Because again, that's one of the themes that runs through the book, is just the intent of James Naismith and what he developed as he developed those 13 original rules. And then kind of as he went on in his life and had an impact on other people who were giant figures in the game. Did you know a lot of that already before you started to sort of do your research for the course and the book? Or was that something that as you got into it more, you were able to see the connections between sort of his original vision and then where the game eventually evolved and then how it played into the principles that you came up with?
I didn't know how much Naismith was a gift that kept on giving, how everything about his lived experience and everything about his vision that came out of that lived experience, his vision for this game, was even more than I could have possibly imagined. You know, that there's two things. One is he invented the game in a time, historical time, that was, you know, a lot like it is now. We were going through a technological revolution where all these new industries and new technologies were being heralded by the people who were coming to the world with them as something that was going to make us more democratic, something that was make everyone wealthier, everyone freer, lives so much better. And of course that began something called the Gilded Age, which did the opposite. It created the greatest wealth inequality that had seen up to that time. It created the greatest government corruption that had been known heretofore. It was a time when the world was kind of falling to pieces. China had just gotten through a civil war called the Boxer Rebellion. Tsarist Russia had pillaged across its poorest and weakest. Europe was in a time of secret alliances, and so you saw the greatest amount of immigration that the United States had ever seen, which resulted in all kinds of hate and resentment toward newcomers, which was already on top of the trauma of the Civil War and emancipation, the awful horror of Jim Crow and the Chinese Exclusion Act. I mean, this was a country in division, social fabric shredded. And here comes this guy who's an immigrant himself, who was traumatized from the loss of his parents at a young age, who was an intellectual misfit wanderer, went to divinity school because he was trying to find a way to make the world a better place, and thought that actually, no, I'm not going to go to the ministry. I'm not going to be a clergy. I'm going to go teach gym. Remarkable. And when he got there, he was tasked with coming up with an invention that would help people who couldn't access. Well, you know, originally it was like, hey, let's help the guys exercise indoors. But he was thinking more missionary. He was thinking more, how can I create something that allows people to be better people? I couldn't believe how much this guy had thought through everything.
One thing that I didn't know that you had in the book was a story of what he used to do, the little game he used to play as a kid that made him think about just the concept of basketball. Talk a little bit about that and where you came across that tidbit of information, because that to me was something I had never read or heard about the story of Naismith.
Naismith was trying to create a different kind of game, a less violent game. And so the first thing he did is make a rule that said nobody can run with the ball. Because he figured if you can't run, they're not going to chase you and tackle you. And then his second rule was, well, how do you advance the ball? Pass. And then the third, totally innovative concept, unprecedented, he elevated the goal. And he got that idea from a game he used to play called Duck on a Rock with other boys in rural Benny's Corners, Ontario. And the idea with Duck on a Rock was there was all the boys were kind of on one side, and then there was another boy kind of guarding the goal on another side. And the idea was you had to throw your rock over where the boy was guarding, and you had to do it in a way that he'd have to chase the rock so you could get to the goal before he'd get to you. And so you had to throw it on a certain kind of arc that was high enough, but not too far and not too fast, that gave you the time to get to the goal, the rock. He thought about arc. He thought about finesse. He thought about a way to balance power and skill, force and finesse. And it was this little game that he played as a boy that inspired him to create an elevated goal. There's no other sport where the goal is elevated. Every other goal, to score a touchdown, a goal in hockey, a strike in baseball, or get to the base in baseball, a goal in soccer, it's about me running past you, rugby, running past you, over you, with more power or more speed. With basketball, they value power and speed, but you've got to be under control. He never imagined how much the game would be above the rim, of course, but it's still that way. The arc, the shot in basketball, the looking up, it's a unique quality among team sports.
That's definitely a perspective that, again, I don't think that I had necessarily ever thought of it in that way that you describe of every other sport with a goal. You're trying to put that ball or put yourself pass through that goal with the maximum amount of force. And it's all on the same plane as opposed to basketball, where, yes, as you said, power and speed are still really important parts of the game, and probably even more important parts than Naismith would have ever imagined. But at the same time, yes, you have to be able to have that skill and dexterity to be able to get that ball up to where it needs to go and drop through the net the way we all love to hear the swish when it goes through. So again, it just made me think of something that in a different way, different from the way that I had thought about it.
Yeah.
As I started, go ahead.
And I just to add, you know, isn't it nice? That principle of the balance of force and skill, it's a principle that allowed all different kinds of athletes to play in this game and star in this game. It wasn't just who was the strongest. It wasn't just who was the fastest. Look at Jokic. This is a game that allows all kinds of people, which stands for the principle. It's almost like a human resources principle. It's a broader lens of who can do what in this world. We've for so long relied on, you know, a certain kind of leader, a certain kind of star, a certain kind of CEO. And I think what basketball says is you should be looking at a range of types to do all the things that we need done. It's a remarkable inclusion of the human potential.
You talked about in the book, and again, going and trying to relate to the game of basketball, but also relating it to issues that we face out there in the world. And you talked about one of the challenges that we have as both a society here in the US, but just in general, that most of our leadership tends to look a certain way and fall into a certain category. And because of that, even though we theoretically have a representative democracy, we're not necessarily representative of who the people are that are governing us. And so just talk a little bit about what the challenge is with that and how basketball relates to what could be a potential solution.
Yeah. I talk in the book about, I equate open run with open democracy. There's this idea of open democracy. It's different than the democracy we have now. There's an argument, that, you know, we have a representative democracy right now. We elect Congress people and senators. But it seems like, and particularly when it comes to senators, that they're all a certain type. They're handsome, they're charismatic, mostly male, wealthy. And we say, well, they represent us, but do they represent us? Is that really what we look like? Open democracy is this idea that, well, maybe we should just have like a, almost like you're drafted for the jury, a random draft of us, citizens, across the spectrum, in far greater number. And we have to serve, and we have to come together and figure it out. Like open run. That's the idea that there's a gym or a court open to the public, anybody can come, and you're thrown together with other people to figure out collectively how you're going to stay on, which is the problem you're meant to solve. And when that happens, you tend to like connect with other people that you've never met before in a much more meaningful way. You tend to value a range of ideas and options in that pickup game, just like an open democracy, that you may never have considered. And what comes of it is probably a more accurate reflection of the five of you, just like an open democracy, is probably a better reflection of the body politic in America than if we just have five leading scorers on one team and nobody getting rebounds. And I think that's the beauty of basketball, is that you come into this as an individual and you are immediately forced to calculate what your needs are versus everyone else's. And in that calculation, if you want success, you may have to give up things. You may have to let some things go. You may have to share the ball because there's only one ball and five of you. And on defense, there's no ball. You all have to do something together. So I see the future of, I'm no longer interested in these old words, capitalism, socialism, communism. They're words that have gotten us to the place we're in now, which is a perpetual argument. I'm interested in the principle of basketball that says you balance the individual and the collective, period. Figure it out among strangers. And if you took away the Constitution, if you took away, the socialist document, if you took away whatever's governing your country right now, you'd pretty much be left with that basic principle. Look around you, look at your neighbors, balance yourself and them. That's it. That's pickup basketball.
It's really well said. And I think that anybody who's experienced pickup basketball and you experienced the opportunity to go and put together a team and get on the court and win some games. And as I said earlier, I was very fortunate to be able to have lots of experience as a kid and a young adult with pickup basketball. And I think that when you start to look at the people that you interact with in the course of pickup basketball, and depending on where you play, I probably started out when I was 13 or 14 years old, going up to the riding my bike up to the local rec park and sort of being befriended by different guys. And I try to get there early so I could always be the first one there so I could get in that first game of 10 and then stick around and be the last guy there. So they're like, hey, the kid still wants to play, so we can throw him into this game. And then you sort of start to find your way and figure it out. And guys know that, hey, this is what this person can do. This is what that person can do. And you just, I think about the diversity of people that I met through basketball and just how it exposed me to people of all different ages, how it exposed me to people of all different races, and how it exposed me just to people who played the game differently and had different personalities. And you learn to figure out, how do you play with this person so that you can still win? And then, like I said earlier, how do you avoid the people that, you know, don't cooperate and don't understand the balance of individual and collective and some of the other principles? And I think there's really no better. To me, it's one of the things that when I look at basketball the way it is today, I think one of the things that a lot of kids miss out on, and this is something that I'm just curious to get your perspective on too, is because kids don't play as much pickup basketball as you, I'm sure, did, and as much as I did. So often now they're in a gym with a coach and referees and their parents and people in the stands and a scoreboard, that I think a lot of the things that makes pickup basketball great, I think sometimes kids don't get as much of that today in the system that we have now, where those kids who used to be just playing on the playground, now they're kind of forced into this other alternative system that's more run by adults. And it's kind of just an interesting, it's a conversation we've had a lot on the podcast, Dave, with different coaches that we've had on. And, you know, obviously, I think as the proverbial old guy, you know, I look back on the way that I grew up and think that was superior. And there's certainly good things about the system that we have today. But I think a lot of the principles, when I'm reading this book, I'm looking at it going, I'm not sure that all the kids are getting, like my own kids, I'm not sure they got the same amount of all this stuff that we're talking about.
Yeah. You know, first of all, I love what you described for yourself and what you learned as you individual, you know, Mike Klintzing brought your body up to that court and participated with these other people. You know, the way you learn to get along with other people, the way you learn to be a citizen among different age groups. You know, you asked me earlier on, like, you know, hey, what did your colleagues in higher education think about this idea when you want to do a course about basketball? And, you know, this is exactly the conversation I want to start having, which is people need to understand that what you and I are talking about, what you did when you rode your bike up to that court and had that experience, became a community member and learned how to be with others, that's academic. That's what they're trying to teach people in civics 101. That's what they're trying to teach people in the history of Western civilization. Well, this is how we came to, you know, give people rights and give people freedom. You learned all that by going up and walking onto a basketball court with 9 other people of different ages, of different orientations. They might have not even have spoken the same language as you. You don't know. This is, to me, you weren't just playing, you were learning. And I mean, it's what, you know, this idea of a specialization, you know, for young kids when they're 9 years old or 8 years old, you got to choose one sport, play it all year round. The over coaching or the over controlling, over organizing. These games were not meant for that. You know, famously, as I discovered again in researching Naismith, after he left Springfield College and he went to Kansas, he'd heard about a young guy who was just tearing it up and promoting games and winning games. His name was Fog Allen. And so he tells Fabi Allen, come to Kansas, play basketball for me. And Allen does. And then very quickly, Allen gets offered a job to coach at a place called Baldwin College. And he comes and tells Naismith, I'm going to leave. And they said, where are you going? He says, I'm going to go coach at Baldwin College. And Naismith laughs. And he says, basketball is not a game to coach. It's a game you play. Now, you and I both know how important good coaching is. That wasn't what he was saying. What he was saying is that this is a very unusual kind of game where you have to figure stuff out. You have to kind of understand how to move your body in spatial relationship to other bodies. You gotta, on the fast break, there's no kind of pulling you over, stopping the clock. There's no, you know, getting in a huddle, stepping out of the batter's box. You're figuring stuff out on the move as the facts and circumstances on the ground change. This is the kind of training that they give entrepreneurs. This is the kind of training they're trying to give in leadership courses. This is what you learn on a basketball court. And I only know that the more you let people, just kids, play, I mean, I don't think they should focus on winning until they're like 16, 17. I think they should just be falling in love with the way their body moves with other bodies in the space, the way they have that humanizing experience, the way they feel a citizen in that community of the court and of the players, the way they solve problems with nobody telling them how to solve those problems. I think that's the way you learn how to play basketball. Intergenerational.
I could not agree more. I think that, as I've said many times, when I think about the experiences that I had, both in becoming the person that I was and becoming the player that I was, I attribute so much of that to my upbringing in the game and just the people that I played with that were, again, all different ages, all different races, from all different places. And I learned little tricks of the trade from each and every person that I came in contact with. And then I think, to your point, you take it a step further and you say, how did I learn how to interact with other people? And I think that's something that I obviously wasn't processing that as you're going through it.
Right.
But I think that when you look back on it retrospectively and you think about the character traits that you have as an adult and how sports, and in this case, basketball in particular for me, how it shaped who I was. And I want to read something that, as I was going through the book, and this is on the very first page. And when I told you that I read the introduction, and so much of that introduction completely resonated with me. But right here on the first page, I'm just going to read a quote from the book, Dave, because it sort of summarized how I think I see myself and how important the game of basketball has been to me, but not just, again, as the game, but just sort of as, I just can't imagine what things would be like without it. So this is what you wrote, and I just wanted you to hear it, that how much it impacted and resonated with me. And I think a lot of people resonate with the same thing. So what you wrote was, I don't see basketball simply as a part of my identity. I see it as an existential matter, as if without it, I'm not really even here. So many understand this, yet it takes one to know one. And when we meet, it only takes a moment before one of us asks the other, do you still play? This is our handshake. This is our measure. It's our check against whether and how much we really are still here. We ask because we know the value of playing. And it's funny because I'm 53 or almost 53, 52. And, you know, people, I'm out there walking around and I'll run into guys and, hey, do you still play? It's a question that I don't care how old you are. People still ask. Unfortunately, my answer now is, my answer is no, I still don't play. Unfortunately, I tore my ACL like 10 years ago, and that was my retirement date. So now I just kind of help my kids and, you know, do my coaching and that kind of thing. But inevitably, we all still ask. I ask people, even though I know my answer is no, I still ask people that I run into that I haven't seen for a while, hey, do you still play? But I think just thinking about basketball and as if without it, I'm not really even here. Like I look around at just everything. I look at my house. I look at my family. I look at my job. I look at this podcast. I look at the people that I know. And so much of it has just come from the game of basketball. It's just, it's incredible to me. And it sounds like you've had a similar experience with the game.
It means so much to me that you seized upon that passage in particular. I think it's one of the most truthful things I've ever written. And I know you feel this, like, I have to play. I get so much back, so much of myself back. Even if I just shoot around, there's something like restorative. There's something that like it's like a vitamin, and it's not like I'm gonna die, right? Because I'm not playing, but I'm not exactly me. You know, I was blown away when you probably remember, like in the pandemic, when it first hit and everybody started freaking out, right? And they're like, you can't go near anybody, you know, you'll die, you know, all this stuff. The one thing that people would not stop doing was going to basketball courts.
Yep.
Remember that?
Yeah, absolutely.
And like the mayor of Chicago, the governor of New York, like, all around the world, like I read this article, like they had to take down the rims because people didn't care. They're like, yeah, I'll lose my life. I don't care. I'm playing basketball today because they needed it. They had to have it because all I know is when I'm doing it, I'm feeling about as alive, about as like complete, as joyous as I feel doing anything. And I come out of that space like healthier, like I'm kinder to animals, you know, like I'm better, like with everyone I see.
I'm going to give you a good example of that. So one of your principles is sanctuary. And so you think about people that talk about, and again, this could be players that we've all heard of that maybe they had a tough upbringing and the court was the place where they went for solace to get away from a bad family situation, or just because they needed to have a place where they could go or where they felt comfortable, where they felt safe, where the world around them sort of recognized what they were. But it's just sometimes it's a place you need to go. So when I was in college, and I'm from Cleveland, Ohio, so I was a Cavs fan, and I love Michael Jordan. And there was an intersection where Michael Jordan and the Cavs met up in the playoffs in 1989. And Jordan hit the shot after the Cavs had swept the Bulls for, they were 5-0 against them in the regular season. And then Michael hits the famous shot over Craig Elo. And I was in college.
Craig Elo.
Yeah. And I was in college at the time. And my reaction to that game, and again, keeping in mind that I was a huge Michael Jordan fan, but I was rooting for the Cavs at that particular time. And I went out to, there were some courts that were on campus that had lower baskets. And even though I was a Division I player, I was not a dunker. So I was a shooter, stamina guy, and not a guy that was playing above the rim. So this particular court had rims that were probably, I don't know, 8.5, 9 feet. And when that game ended and the shot went in, I took my ball and I went out to those courts and just dunked my way into oblivion to try to get out my anger and frustration over that game. So again, I chose basketball, wound up my emotions in one direction, and then I used the game of basketball to go back and release some of those emotions. So I think it's just, there's so many people that as I was reading, and again, it's a theme that runs through the book, is how many people use the game to be able to not even necessarily escape, but you go to a place that makes you feel comfortable. And sometimes that allows you to escape from your real world, your real life, and just experience something that is completely on another plane, on another level. And I think so many people who play the game kind of understand it. And it also goes to something else that you talk about, which is basketball is really the only sport where it's pretty fun to play by yourself, and you can work on the game and you can get better at the game by yourself. Whereas most other team sports, it's pretty hard to do that in anything else besides basketball. So I know I hit on a couple of different principles in that story, but I just thought it was relevant to kind of what we've been talking about.
Well, it is, because, you know, the book is these 13 principles that I've drawn from basketball, these kind of like big ideas that I think basketball stands for. They're only good if we can use them. And I believe that they address acute 21st century problems. And one of those problems, is this thing that people seem to get from basketball, this sanctuary. It's one of the principles, this place you can go, the safe space, the space that you can just get away from whatever it is you want to get away from, or escape, or just find like some meditative, you know, kind of peace to be alone, to be with others. Never has there been a time in human history where that has been so needed and necessary. In this time when, you know, this kind of digital oppression, this constant surveilling of us, this requirement that you be tracked, updated, counted, measured, you know, all these analytics, this algorithmic, never ending kind of feedback. We need spaces. We need the kind of thing that so many people, as you said, have said, this is what basketball does for me. We need, like, I, in the book, I call it, it needs to be like a fundamental right, like something in like the Constitution. But we must insist on a break from this, because if you don't, you start to lose your mind. I don't mean you go crazy. I mean, you give up your mind to this larger kind of algorithmic hive mind. I came upon a story that Gary Smith had wrote for Sports Illustrated about one of the only people who didn't drink the Kool-Aid in Jonestown in Guyana were a group of basketball players that were in the cult. Somehow basketball had separated their consciousness from the cult consciousness that led to mass suicide. Now, why was it the basketball players? I know why, and you know why. Because it gives us this space where we're not connected to all this other stuff. We're only connected to the other human beings and ourself, which allows us to have some kind of sense of our full humanity, which allows us to shut off from all that other bullshit. It's freedom, just like those guys could find the ability to break free from the cult. Basketball stands for sanctuary. It stands for, like, we must have this space to not be subject to this, I mean, unbelievable geo-tracking. You know, this, you know, and again, I'm not against technology. I'm for humanity. So I think it's a powerful thing that basketball has done for a lot of people. And it stands for a really important thing, which we need as a society. We're going to get lost, in, you know, in kind of, a a kind of a digital hostage taking of our lives.
The first training camp Elite Skill Development and Performance Combine will be held on the campus of Western Reserve Academy, just outside of Cleveland, Ohio, powered by Unleash Potential and the Hoopheads podcast. The camp is designed for boys rising to grades 6 through 9 and will take place June 29th through July 1st, 2023. An emphasis on improving individual skills in the context of a team environment will be the hallmark of the training camp. Mike Klinzing from Head Start Basketball and the Hoopheads podcast and Joe's Decision from Unleashed Potential will serve as the camp directors of this inaugural training camp. Campers can expect 3 days of hard work, intense skill instruction, and learning how to be a great teammate on and off the court at the training camp. Players will participate in 10 elite skill development sessions led by some of the best coaches from across the country. Visit headstartbasketball.com to get registered.
It's think time to me people miss out on. I think when you look at the generation of my oldest child's 18, my youngest is 13. And so they've grown up and they were the last kids in their grade probably to get a phone. My daughter got one when she was in ninth grade. My son got his when he was in 10th. And I have a seventh grader who still doesn't have one.
Yeah.
And we're oddities. They're oddities.
Yeah.
In their world. And I think one of the things, and look, I'm as guilty of it as anybody, where there's times that I'm going for a walk or I'm walking from one room to another and my phone's in my pocket. And what do? I pull it out and I'm looking at NBA scores or I'm scrolling through Twitter for 15 seconds or whatever it is. And I think that if you look back to the time when you and I grew up, those were times where you were thinking or you were on the basketball court and you were imagining and you were pretending to be this player or that player. Or you were replaying game 7 of the NBA finals or the NCAA championship game. And now I think kids, instead of reaching into their mind, they reach for their phone. And it's completely understandable. It's tempting for us as adults. And I think that this idea of sanctuary, this idea of providing people a way, a means to be able to detox from that digital world that we all spend so much time in, it's hard, but it's definitely something that's needed. Because I think that what we've done is we've replaced our own thinking with, again, this algorithmic concept that you're talking about, where we know what social media does. And once you click on one thing, they just keep feeding you more and more and more of that same thing. And that's where we get this sort of ideological divide that we're in right now as a country, which you talked a lot about in the book, of just ways that we can try to combat that. And I think that thinking is something that we underrate, and it's something that we don't get a lot of, both as kids today. And then certainly us as adults are just as guilty.
Well, you know, it's, I'll give you some hope. I read two stories within a week. One was that there's, a study that just came out, that showed that the biggest trend in toy buying is from a new segment, demographic segment that they call kid adults. Basically, adults who want toys. And this consumer behavior is driven by adults who just, they can't take it anymore. They just want to be kids again. They want that kind of play. And then the second story I read was about a group of kids in Brooklyn. They formed a club. And they call themselves the Luddites. And they meet in the park, in Prospect Park. And the only requirement for membership is you can't bring your phone.
That's very cool.
Yeah. They're starting to be this kind of I think we're hitting a breaking point where everyone's saying enough. And you know, you and I are sitting here saying on your podcast, well, we know, like, 'cause we're into this game that that kind of does that, you know, that's why we love it.
It's such a powerful force that we have in, as a society and just as parents and looking at where we are from a technology standpoint and just making sure that our kids are, again, as you said, I'm not against technology and I'm clearly using it all the time. And it's something that I think in many ways has brought us the ability to do things that clearly we never could before. But it's such a danger when you start thinking about if that replaces free and independent thought and being able to figure things out on your own instead of just having things fed to you. And I think that's the concern. And I think that basketball and certainly the sanctuary that it provides is definitely something that if we think about it in that realm and we can get people to think about it in that way, I think the world would be a better place.
Yes.
All right. I want to ask you about Wilt Chamberlain because in your, one of your principles is the balance of force and skill. And in that chapter, you talk a lot about Wilt and what made him so unique as a player. And you have one page where you cite some of his records. And I know one of the things that I was not young enough. I was not old enough to be able to see Wilt at his best. And clearly there are highlights out there, but more of my knowledge of Wilt comes from just reading and looking at the statistics and thinking about these statistics compared to everything else that I see just don't look real. And you hear the stories about how his contemporaries described Wilt as an athlete, but just talk about what made Wilt Chamberlain to you so compelling of a figure that you wanted to include him in the book and just how that plays into the balance of force and skill.
Yeah. You know, the balance of force and skill, we talked about it, how it's, kind of a special appreciation that basketball insisted on of the widest possible range of athletic gifts, not just power and speed, but the ability to do all different kinds of skillful things. I think Wilt Chamberlain was a perfect example of someone whose talent wasn't recognized, his full talent. He was only seen as a kind of freakish Goliath, a tremendously tall and powerful figure. And no one was as tall or as powerful. And that was Wilt Chamberlain. But that simply wasn't true. Wilt was a gifted athlete. All around athlete. He could do the finesse things. He invented the finger roll. He loved to pass the ball. He was completely misunderstood and wasn't ever appreciated. And I make the point where even one season he averaged over 48 minutes a game because he had played in overtime, like every minute of every game. He, what was it? He, his points per game and his rebounds per game were off the charts. So like, 50 points a game where it was like unbelievable. And he didn't get voted MVP because there was this constant bias based on just the way he looked, big, powerful. It was almost, of course, he should be doing what he should be doing. You almost had to root against him. I'm not going to go into Wilt Chamberlain's character. I can't vouch for that. All I can say is that Wilt was so far ahead of his time, and he was actually what the game looks like now. He's the Antetokounmpo. He's the 7-footer who can do it all. That Wilt Chamberlain for me stands for the wider lens that we should have for all the things, all the societal institutions, college admissions, job applications, leadership types. We have to stop measuring by kind of old standards of sheer numeric or sheer, charisma. And the principle of the balance of force and skill as embodied by Will Chamberlain is you've got to work a lot harder to see the full person. And when you do that, you're going to give more people the opportunity to lead, give more people a seat at the table. It's an inclusion principle. And it's one that's, based on Nate Smith's original idea to make the game based on passing and movement and scoring in an elevated goal and requiring the understanding of your ability to share space with other people. And he created a game that gave a lot more of us the chance to do a lot more. And so it was a breakthrough principle, not just in athletics, but in the way we evaluate talent here.
I think that's a great point about evaluating talent, because I think that's one of the things that you hear about a lot in sports, obviously, where that's where we typically tend to think of talent. But obviously, we can think of talent in many, many different areas besides just the sports world. And to your point, I think too often we look for whatever those telling marks or those telling signs or those telling characteristics that we think we associate with success in a particular area. And too often then we end up excluding people who could be very, very successful, but for whatever reason, the screening process eliminates them before they even get a chance to get started. I know there's lots of things out there about youth sports, how depending upon your birthday, and that's the Malcolm Gladwell, the birthday's early in the year, then you get picked because you're a year older than the kids who were born later in the year. And just, again, we're not selecting truly for talent. We're just selecting for kids who are more physically mature. And there's all kinds of examples throughout that of those things that happen. It's just, it's so interesting that you chose, to me, it's so interesting that you chose Wilt Chamberlain as sort of the poster child for that. Because in my mind, if you had asked me before I read this, I would almost say that Wilt was sort of almost the antithesis of that, in that he checked off, if you just looked at him, he checked off every box of exactly what you would want. But your point is that you need to see him in a more nuanced way, that he wasn't just this brute force Goliath, so much bigger than everybody else, but he was also a guy that had that skill, had that technique, had that finger roll, had the fadeaway jumper off the backboard, had the ability to long jump and high jump and all the different things that he could have done as an athlete. I've said a million times to people that if I look at players in the past, because obviously there's always this comparison of, well, how would players in the past be able to play today? And this guy couldn't play. And, you got the Jordan versus LeBron debate. And clearly the evolution of athletes collectively as a group today in 2023 are better than they were in 1960. I mean, there's just no question about that. But I've always told people that if you look at players in the past in the NBA, if you want to take one guy and drop that one guy into today's NBA that could still athletically play on an NBA court today without any question and play probably not quite to the dominant level that he was, but pretty close to me, Wilt's the guy. I think you could take him.
Yeah.
You could take 1960 Wilt Chamberlain and drop him into a game in 2023 and he would not look out of place. Whereas I think there are lots and lots of guys who were stars in their era who you drop them into a game today and they would look out of place. Wilt would not look out of place.
Yeah, you're right. I think you're 100% right, Mike. And you can even old photos can tell you that. You look at the guy, you're like, oh, okay.
So true. So true. Another principle that I love that we haven't really hit on, and I think it's relevant to what we're talking about and something that I think kind of relates to both our experiences, is the idea that the game is both urban and rural. And I think it's something that is unique in that it appeals to people who grew up in the city and it appeals to people who grew up in the country. You think about the history of New York City playground basketball, and then you think about the history of Indiana basketball and kids growing up and shooting on the barn versus kids growing up and going to Rucker Park. So just talk a little bit about urban and rural and A, how that relates to basketball, but then how you related it to some of the issues that we have in society today.
Yeah, it's as you say, I mean, I don't think anyone will argue that this is a game that is equally loved in Kentucky, Indiana, West Virginia, as it is in Harlan, Compton, and Watts. It's an urban and rural game. There's certainly different legends and lore that come out of both places. But this is a game that has lots of legend and love in both those environments. And I make the point again that we have a particular 21st century problem, and that is division. And there seems to be a great division between urban and rural. We find people kind of actively moving to communities, either urban or rural, so they can be around people who agree with them and think like them. These disagreements and divisions are reflected in the way people vote, in the kinds of television shows they watch, the food they eat, the cultural attitudes, values, all kinds of things. How do we, and by the way, it's not just the United States. I mean, this urban rural divide is true in European countries, Asian countries. It's a thing. How do we bridge that divide? How do we start somewhere to find something that we all have in common? And the one thing that I think basketball stands for is this shared common love in both urban and rural communities. And when folks from urban places go to rural places and folks from rural places go to urban places, and they worry that, like, where am I going to go? What am I going to do here? How, where can I find my people? If you go to a basketball court, it's almost like going to a castle that has your coat of arms. You know, it says, you're welcome here. You can pray at this altar. You can, participate in this ceremony. And I don't know how many things there are that are like that. But if we can find this one thing, if we can get on a basketball court and understand each other, well, okay, we can at least admit we have that, which may allow us to, like, at least consider that there may be other things which may get us to more things that we see we have in common, which may lessen, I'm not going to say it's ever going to eliminate, but at least lessen the divide between us that seems to be insisted upon. I use the one example of Magic and Bird, who, everybody wanted to say how different they were, and then they actually spent some time together and they became best friends for life. I think we need to find solutions to the urban and rural divide in the 21st century. It's going to be a major continuing problem. I think basketball stands for finding things that are urban and rural. And so that's what that principle's about.
What's the pickup basketball scene look like in New York City today?
It's not, I think some people would feel like it's not what it used to be. That it's not healthy enough. But that has a lot to do with, oh, where's the college basketball in New York City? Where's the great high school programs? You know, everybody's going to the prep schools in Jersey or the prep schools all over the country. They're going to Toronto. But I don't think that's what makes this thing healthy. I think the pickup basketball scene is really strong because there's a lot of basketball courts. People ask me, how do you make a community better? You know, after I have a talk about this book and they say, what's the one thing we should do? What's the thing we should do next? I'm like, you should build courts. Because if you build courts, people come. And when people come, they have the experience that we've been talking about. And it civilizes a community. It knits it together. So I think the pickup scene, I don't know if the organic, homegrown kind of, you know, legends of the, you know, they used to read about in Rucker Park and this kind of thing and in the parks in Brooklyn. I don't know if that's still happening because it's just a very different world now. But I think there's still pretty robust pickup. I walk by the cage almost every day on West 4th Street and there's ball being played. My friend Bobito Garcia, he will tell you there is ball being played everywhere in every corner as long as those rims are up.
That's good to hear. I think there's certainly, at least here in Cleveland, I know it's not nearly what it was back when I was a kid in terms of like the quality of player to what you described that you find playing, especially outdoor pickup basketball. I think the other thing that's different, I don't know how it is in New York City, but one of the things that I feel like is different here is that there's a lot more access to gyms and indoor space than there was in the 70s and 80s where those things were locked up tight when school ended or whatever. You weren't getting in there no matter what, unless you really were good friends with a janitor or your dad was a coach. Otherwise, it was really tough to get gym space. And so people played outside. And I don't see, at least around here, I don't see the number of people playing pickup playground basketball as they used to. I see them playing still, again, inside. People find places to play inside. A lot of people are playing in organized when you talk about like a men's league or that kind of thing. So it's just interesting the way that the game has shifted in some way to being more of an indoor game than an outdoor game, especially for some of the better players at the high school and college level that if you say, hey, we used to play, I worked on my game all the time outside, they kind of look at you like you're crazy. What do you mean? Because they just have more gym access than I think certainly than I did, and probably your experience is similar. I want to ask you one final question related to the book, and then we'll talk a little bit about where people can get it and go into that at the very end. But the last principle I want to talk about is actually the first one, which is cooperation. And I think it speaks to all the things that we've been talking about, which is when you're on a basketball court, you have to cooperate with your teammates. I think that goes without saying, but you talked a little bit about a bigger piece of it, which is just sort of putting people, and you mentioned it with the Magic and Bird part too, that just putting people together in places, especially when you're talking about kids where you have kids from two diverse backgrounds that maybe their cultures could clash or clash in the world. And then you put those kids together and you see that melt away. You talked about Peace Players International, but just tell us a little bit about how just putting people in proximity to one another on a basketball court leads to more cooperation, understanding, which ultimately can lead to a better world, which is kind of the whole premise behind the book.
I love that you went to the first principle last. I really do, because it's simple. You know, basketball is built on a very, in a way, a very simple principle of cooperation. But there's one requirement. You got to be in the same space, same small, intimate space. And when you do that, you have a human experience. And we keep saying humanize. What does that mean? It actually means that I see you and all your reactions, and you see all my reactions, and it's happening in real time, and it's happening at you know, like in milliseconds, and there's all kinds of synchronicity and reactions to reactions that are reactions. This has been called, you know, it's a neurological as well as a physiological thing going on, mirror neurons, where you look at me and kind of smile, and then I look at you and nod my head, and then I kind of move my shoulder, and then you move. All these things matter in the way we communicate. They are social cues. And the better we are at kind of understanding each other in that way, the higher we go in what we're able to do together in that exquisite communication. But that only happens in person. That only happens when I can really see you. Basketball insists on being in space together. And I believe if you extend that principle, and so that's the principle of cooperation. And so you call it what you will. You can call it empathy. You can call it, communication. You can call it understanding, call it cooperation. But what's happening is that you're having a connection to another human being in a really fulsome, detailed way. And there's no other way, in my opinion, that you're going to have an excellent work experience unless you do that. There's no other way, in my opinion, that you're going to create international relations unless the people from those nations see each other in a room for some quality amount of time. There's no way you're going to have any type of friendship or communal project of any kind, unless I really trust you, which requires me to have some significant emotional experience with you. Peace Players is an organization that has won tons of awards. And what they do is use basketball as a tool to help young people in the highest conflict spots on earth, you know, Northern Ireland, Israel, Palestine, Turkey, Cyprus, South Africa, to help these people see each other. Because they believe that if you see each other and you're in this kind of positionless, scheme, that you'll begin to break down the thing you imagine the person was, which wasn't good, and see the person, the individual. Peace Players did a 7-year randomized controlled study, the kind of study you do on medicine, because it's got to be right, which proved, particularly they studied their Israel-Palestinian kids, that these kids left their programs believing much more positively about kids from other cultural backgrounds. They left their programs with pro-social behaviors going back to their communities and standing up and saying, you know, no, don't say that. That's not true because I've been with them. You know, the South African Zulu-based principle called Ubuntu. It's a word in the Zulu culture, which is spread across Africa, which means I am because you are. In other words, I'm inseparable from you. That's the only thing that makes me. Maybe that's what I mean when I say basketball is existential to me. Because I understand, whether I like it or not, that we're on this earth with other people who are not me, who are not my family. And the best times are when I feel in sync with them. The best things get done when I'm basketballing, which means I'm with them, not on Zoom. I'm with them in a room, on a court. And that's what that principle, that powerful principle. It's the beginning. It's the, in the book, I say it's the fork in the road. Every morning you get up, you can choose to kind of be with other people in a way that where you see each other, or you can go hide behind a million social media posts or something else, which leads us to a less cooperative kind of environment, a less cooperative mindset, and therefore there'll be less peace, less production, all the things that we want.
I think basketball takes us and them and makes it we. And yeah, when you look at this principle of cooperation, to me, that's really what it's all about. When you think about circling back to the beginning of our conversation and pick up basketball and you bring a group of five people together. And at first it's me and them. And after you play together and you win a game or two, all of a sudden it's not me and them, it's we. And that's powerful. And on a pickup basketball court, it happens quickly. And obviously in the real world, it's a much slower process, but I think it's a process that basketball proves can work. And as you said,
you know, there's that one story that I hit on in the book. I was lucky enough to I was in a parked car in Philadelphia and I was listening to the Sonny Hill show. Sonny Hill's a great, the Hall of Fame basketball player out of Philadelphia. And it was in the time that Shaquille O'Neal was just dominating. No one could stop him. You had to foul him. That was the only way he couldn't score. He was just so physically just so much bigger and stronger than everyone else. Sonny Hill was interviewing Bill Russell. Bill Russell has won more championships than anyone by far. And he had bested the Goliath of his day, who, you know, we had talked about the caricatured as Goliath, Will Chamberlain. So he said, Bill, you'll know what to do. Sonny Hill asked Bill Russell, Bill, how would you stop Shaquille O'Neal? I'll never forget it. It was almost like a 10 second pause before Russell answered. And he was like, I wouldn't. And Sonny Hill's like, what? You wouldn't? Bill, come on, man. He said, no, he goes, I wouldn't. He goes, my team would. That's what you're talking about. That's the me to we. That's basketball where you can't. Russell couldn't conceive of himself in that game doing anything without being connected to the four other guys on his team. That's how it works. That's a really high consciousness.
You can't really adequately describe it with words, although you did a heck of a job doing that. But I think it's one of those things that you know it when you feel it. And you've probably played on teams just like I have that had that level of cooperation and that alchemy and all the things that we talked about tonight. And then you played on other teams where that's not there. But that Bill Russell story, I think, sums up what makes basketball so great and what makes it so special is when you have five individuals that come together and cooperate and they create something new, something better, something bigger than themselves. That's what coaches, we talk to coaches on the podcast, Dave, all the time about that is, you know, one of the greatest things about being on a team and playing in a team sport is that it gives you an opportunity to be a part of something that's bigger than yourself, something that you couldn't possibly accomplish on your own, but this group of individuals that come together and form something new can. And to me, that's the magic of basketball.
Amen.
All right, brother, let's go ahead and tell people about the book. When's it going to go on sale? Where are they going to be able to find it? Give us any other relevant information. Share your website, your social media, everything, how they can reach out to you, find out more. This has been a lot of fun, but just share how people can connect with you and how they can get the book.
Thank you, Mike. You've been incredibly gracious and kind. My book is called How Basketball Can Save the World, 13 Principles, 13 Guiding Principles to Reimagine What's Possible. How Basketball Can Save the World, 13 Guiding Principles to Reimagine What's Possible. You can buy it wherever books are sold. It releases on February 7th. There's the, you know, Kindle version, audio version, Audible version, every kind of version. You can go to the website, howbasketballcansavetheworld.com, on Instagram, at howbasketballcansavetheworld. You can call Mike Klinzing, and he will tell you, where to buy it in,
absolutely. I will be more than happy to do that. This is a book that I can honestly say that for anyone who loves the game of basketball, it's not a coaching book. It's not an X's and O's book. It's not a building culture book, but I can guarantee you that if you love the game of basketball, you will love this book. It will make you think. It will have tons of aha moments where you will be reading and you will recognize experiences, things that resonate with you that you experience in your own life as a basketball player, a basketball coach. You will recognize those things in this book. And Dave, it is extremely well done. I cannot thank you enough for taking the time out of your schedule to jump on with us and talk about the book and talk about all the different principles and just to give me an opportunity to share some of my stories and impressions that came rushing back to me as I read the book. So again, thank you. I'm truly appreciative. And to everyone out there, thanks for listening. And we will catch you on our next episode. Thanks.
Your first impression is everything when applying for a new coaching job. A professional coaching portfolio is the tool that highlights your coaching achievements and philosophies, and most of all, helps separate you and your abilities from the other applicants. The Coaching Portfolio Guide is an instructional membership-based website that helps you develop a personalized portfolio. Each section of the portfolio guide provides detailed instructions on how to organize your portfolio in a professional manner. The guide also provides sample documents for each section of your portfolio that you can copy, modify, and add to your personal portfolio. As a Hoopheads Pod listener, you can get your Coaching Portfolio Guide for just $25. Visit coachingportfolioguide.com/hoopheads to learn more.
Head Start Basketball.